Welcome to the Wisdom and Wealth Podcast, a series of conversations designed to equip you, our listener, with the helpful insights necessary to simplify the critical decision points of life. I'm Josh Clues, a wealth advisor with Carson Wealth here in the Woodlands, Texas. I believe my calling in this life is to enable others to fulfill their own calling by helping them harness their financial wealth to their purpose in life. Please join me each week for market thoughts, planning ideas, and most importantly, intangible balance sheet discussions, which highlight the importance of all those things money can't buy and death can't take away. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. Welcome in to another episode of Wisdom and Wealth. I'm Josh Clues, as always, and today is another of our intangible balance sheet series of podcasts that we release on the weekends. And for those listeners that may be newer to the podcast, we call it the intangible balance sheet because I believe that there are life principles, life stories, and experiences that live on in our family's heritage or our personal heritage that mean more to us than any amount of money. If given any amount of money, we wouldn't trade them because they're the experiences that make us us. And typically, those come to life through stories. And today, David Van Fleet is my guest today. David, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
I'm glad to be here.
And David,
it contributes something.
Absolutely. And David, before we dive in, can you just briefly introduce yourself to our audience before we dive into our formal conversation?
Well, that's a good question. I spent over 50 years as a university professor at Arizona State, Texas A&M, University of Akron, and the University of Tennessee, which is where I got my degrees. And over 50 years teaching mostly graduate students.
Now, so what subject did you teach or what subjects did you teach?
I taught management and organizational behavior and sometimes human resources.
Got it. I was a big fan of disorganizational behavior, frankly, but just bad joke. Sorry.
So, well, that's interesting you mentioned that because I have a new book coming out and the title is Dysfunctional Organizations.
Ah, which after the fall of mankind, they're plentiful, right?
So yeah,
that's awesome.
Be available in about a month or 2 months, something like that.
Now, is that it's obviously probably not your first book, I'm imagining, or is it the first book?
About my 13th book.
Okay, that's what I figured. All right, excellent.
The first several were simply textbooks. But at some point, I've switched from writing textbooks for students to trade books for managers.
I think we've only had a couple published authors on, but I think definitely 13 takes the crown for most published. So, we'll have to figure out what noticeable award you get, going forward, but to be determined.
There's not much money in it, I can tell you that.
So, David, one of the things that we like to focus on the podcast are those stories that come to us by way of our grandparents or great grandparents. Are there any stories that come to mind that come to you by way of your grandparents that you wouldn't mind sharing with us?
Well, I never really knew my grandparents, except for one grandmother. And her English was pretty good, despite the fact that she had come from Ireland. But the biggest thing I can remember from her is frugal.
Mm.
Always be frugal. Count your pennies. Be careful how you spend your money. And that sort of set a life lesson. It's an important thing that happened in my life. My wife was also an academic. And when we got married, we had agreed to live on one income and invest the other income. And that proved to be the wisest decision we ever made.
Now, I want to ask you about your wife next, but before I get there, are there any stories that live on from your parents that you wouldn't mind sharing with us that influenced your, just the way that you have lived your life?
Well, my father was, I want to say, a little bit remote. I mean, he was always busy, but never too busy not to, you know, plan family vacation, that sort of thing. But my mother ran the household and saw to it that, you know, we made our beds every day and we ate our meals, whether we liked it or not. And those are important lessons, I think. You know, learning self-discipline, even when it's not comfortable.
Now, David, the other piece that I find interesting is, are there, you know, maybe it's the barbershop effect is what I'll call it, but are there mentors that you remember from your community growing up that influenced your thinking or influenced the trajectory of your life?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I grew up in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is the atomic city. And it was a wonderful place to grow up. It was very safe, so the kids were always, we were always on the streets till well after dark and all summer long, you know, so we had plenty of free time to do things and all. But it also was, because it was basically a scientific community, they had very top-rate schools with heavy emphasis on science and math. And I was in a group that was sort of the equivalent of, we were nerds. That's what we were. You know, so in high school, for instance, most of the male students took Spanish and the female students took French, but the nerds took German. And there was a small group of us, and we kept together and sort of reinforced ourselves in terms of always wanting to learn, always stretching the boundaries of knowledge, as it were. And that probably is what pushed me to a career in teaching.
Now, can you explain a little bit more the draw towards German? Was that more because of the engineering bent, or was that just, hey, it was challenging, and so you wanted to learn the language?
Well, we wanted to be different.
Got it.
As I say, the guys were all studying Spanish and the girls were studying French, but the nerds wanted to be different. So we actually petitioned the school. They didn't have a class in German, but we petitioned the school, and one teacher said, well, yeah, she could teach that. And so a small group of us, 20 some odd, became German scholars. But it also was clearly useful for most of the rest of the nerds, because they went into science. I started in engineering, but my first year at the university in engineering, I was taking an engineering drawing class, and we had to do a freehand sketch. And when I did the freehand sketch, the instructor came by afterwards and said, I want you to just draw me a straight line. The official noticed to me that I had essential tremors. And after that, I actually got medical verification of that.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you for listening to the podcast and also ask for a favor. If you could, please subscribe to and rate the podcast via your favorite podcast app, as this is going to help us serve more listeners. Also, if you have a specific question or a guest suggestion for the podcast, please reach out at jklooz@carsonwealth.com. Now, let's get back to the podcast. Thanks again. So back then, you know, that would have been, you know, everything that you would have been like engineering was essentially, as I'm understanding it, or I think I understand it, was very tied to your ability to be able to sketch what you were mathematically proving, correct?
Well, yeah, and my father was an engineer, and all my brothers were engineers. So when I found that out, the instructor advised me to think about another major, and so I switched to management in the College of Business.
Was that, how did you take that? How did you absorb that? Was it a disappointment? Was it a setback, or was it just something that you embraced and moved on? Like, how did you take that,
well,
that admonishment?
Two aspects of it. I mean, one, yeah, it was a little disappointing. I wasn't going to be following the same path as my father and my brothers. But on the other hand, it gave me a little identity so that I wasn't on the same path. I was doing something different and unique. And that felt good. Also felt my nerdishness supported by that as well.
Mm. Now, David, you'd mentioned your wife earlier. How'd you all meet?
Well, when I started the doctoral program at the University of Tennessee, she was in a master's program. And we met, and she didn't like me at all. She thought I was a snobbish, egotistical, and she didn't like me at all. And she got her degree and left. She went to the University of South Florida to teach. And after 2 years there, they had advised her to go back, get a doctoral degree. And when she came back, we met again. And somehow either I had changed or she had changed or whatever. But from that point on, we were a couple.
Mm-hmm. Now, so who?
She finished her degree a semester ahead of me, but delayed her commencement so the two of I could go across the stage at the same time.
Now, was it, go ahead and be honest, was it hard to date someone and be a part of, you know, a rigorous academic environment at the same time and stay focused, or how did you deal with that?
Because our subject matters were very different from one another. So, you know, we could trade, you know, gripes about the bad teachers or something, or the workload or whatever. But it didn't interfere that much, because actually both of us at the time when she had come back, we were no longer in coursework as much as we were independently working on our doctoral dissertations.
Got it.
And then, because we both could use the computer and we're both accustomed to long hours. So we spent a long time in the same room, but working on different computers, doing our own work. So, you know, we could talk to one another, but we were living separate lives, sort of.
Mm. Now, David, are there any pivotal life events that that you look back on that help shape you and help shape your principles and bring them to life at all that you wouldn't mind sharing with us?
Well, I suppose it was, you know, very useful to have a solid family upbringing. And then, you know, the idea of, you know, watching your money, being careful not to go overboard on things. So that, as I say, when my wife and I then both started teaching, we just said, okay, we only need to live on one income. And up to that point, we were on graduate student incomes, which were, you know, minuscule compared to what we first got hired to be. So we thought we were living high on the hog with one income, and we were able to invest the other income, and we kept that up while she worked. Although when kids came along, she became more of a part-time faculty member, but varied. You know, at Texas A&M, she won a national teaching award for an entrepreneurship class that she had developed there. And, but, you know, she was only paid, you know, a part-time instructor's salary, but it was wonderful to have the experience. She co-taught it with a multimillionaire of Texas that some of your listeners might recognize his name because he tried to run for president at one time. He's Clayton W. Williams, Jr.
Okay.
Clayton, as he was called, was a good friend of ours for years. And I think the fact that, you know, when I think back of that, the fact that, you know, he was a multimillionaire, but he still lived in the same house where he grew up. And, you know, on a ranch and still wore his cowboy boots and, you know, a big buckle on the belt and that sort of thing. So he was very down-to-earth individual, despite the fact that he was extremely wealthy.
David, thank you so much for the background, just those life events. The next piece that I always explore with guests of the podcast is I want you to think four generations from now. You know, your great grandchildren's generation or their community. What principles would you, if you had your druthers, what life principles would you want most for them to consider and to live?
Well, I suppose thirst for knowledge, honesty, and, you know, look before you leap. Don't make decisions quickly, especially if money or careers are at stake. Have to excuse this cough. I've got to deal with something on that.
Oh, it's going around. Now, are there any stories behind those admonitions that you wouldn't mind sharing with us at all?
Well, the thirst for knowledge has always been a driving force for me. And I tried to instill that in my children, and I would instill it in just about everybody I meet, try to get my grandkids to be constantly, you know, learning, learn more, learn different things. Don't just stick to the curriculum. You know, go outside and do wonderful things, but always be honest. Be honest with yourself. Be honest with your friends, your parents, your teachers, and that sort of thing. Because I sort of grew up with the honesty is the best policy admonition. And then, you know, being careful that you don't make decisions too quickly. Because it's in today's world, especially, there's a lot of pressure, some of it social pressure, but a lot of pressure to get things done fast. And I think you're better off if you get things done slowly. You know, don't move too quickly. There are opportunities. People will say, you know, well, they'll pass you by if you don't act. Well, I can imagine that there'll be others coming along. So just wait for your turn will come.
I like that. Now, the last piece, David, is I think you've hit on some of this, but I always try to admonish folks to write their eulogy. And it has a little bit of the begin with the end in mind principle. But for me, it helps me crystallize what's important and what's, you know, superfluous. But I'm curious, what would some of the elements of your eulogy be? And what do you want most to be remembered by others as you look back on life?
Well, what I would want my family to remember was that I cared. That I cared about them, I cared about others, and I tried to make the world a better place in a little way by teaching, by writing, and by the way I act. And I guess I would try to build that in to my eulogy. I was thinking of my wife's eulogy, and you know, she built a lot of that in hers because she'd grown up very, very poor and had to, you know, overcome that. She also, her father died when she was in a drowning accident when she was very young. Mm-hmm. So their mother had to raise four girls by herself. And, you know, she learned hard work and dedication to others and that sort of thing, which is why she became a teacher. And actually, mm-hmm. you know, originally when I started graduate school, I wasn't thinking about teaching. I wasn't thinking about anything. I'd been in school. I'm good at being in school. So I just stayed in school. And then, you know, she came along, and to her, it was all about teaching. It's all about helping mm-hmm. others and helping other people learn. And that sort of caught me up. So she taught me, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would want to pass on, is a thirst for knowledge, but also when you get the knowledge, pass it on to others.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you're trying to do in your broadcasts. You're trying to pass along knowledge to others to help them.
Yes, absolutely. And David, the last thing I'll leave you with, and feel free to, you know, because I'm springing this on you, but I've wanted to start doing this. I'd like to offer guests an opportunity to talk about any charity or non-for-profit organization that they're passionate about, and share that with others. Is there anything that comes to mind that you wouldn't mind sharing with us about that you you stand behind and you are passionate about?
Well, my wife passed away to Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
So I'm a strong advocate of supporting Parkinson's foundations, and I have had several relatives pass with cancer, including my daughter.
Mm.
So I'm also a strong supporter of cancer organizations, a variety of ones.
Excellent.
So, Parkinson's and cancer, but you know, I guess because they touched my lives, I'm trying to give back to them.
Yep, absolutely. Are there any in particular that you recommend that people consider when they're thinking about their charitable donations at all?
Well, I guess most people would probably tend to pick charity organizations based on, like my case, based on experiences or friends yeah. they've had or something of that sort. You know, it's hard for me to even think of others.
Yeah. Oh, no. I just meant specifically within the Parkinson's realm or the cancer realm. But no, I really appreciate your admonition there.
Well,
I think
Cancer Society is a
yeah.
big one. And then the Parkinson's, there's a foundation. My doctor back in Arizona was a tremors doctor, but also a Parkinson's doctor, Dr. Holly Schill. She's the director of the Muhammad Ali Center for Movement Disorder. And so I've supported her organization as well as the National Parkinson's Organization.
Excellent. Thank you for that. David,
probably,
thank you so much for...
I should probably also point out here that to deal with my tremors, I've gone to UCLA and had deep brain stimulation surgery, where they implant electrodes in your head and run wires down to a control device on your chest. And that does tremendous help for tremors and also for Parkinson's patients. So I'm also nowadays supporting the work of UCLA dealing with tremors and Parkinson's.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for that. I find that it's always interesting. Like there's always, to your point, there's a story about why we're passionate about something, but when it touches your life, when an organization touches your life or touches your family's life, you know, it's hard not to be passionate about it. David, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your story and your wisdom with us. We wish you and your family nothing but truth, beauty, and goodness in the road ahead, and hope our paths cross again sometime soon, okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you again for joining us. We trust that this time has left you better equipped to steward both your wealth and your financial resources. May you and your family find truth, beauty, and goodness on the road ahead. The opinions voiced in the Wisdom and Wealth podcast by Josh Clues are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested into directly. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. No strategy assures success or protects against loss. To determine what may be appropriate for you, please consult with your attorney, accountant, financial, or tax advisor prior to investing. The guests on the Wisdom and Wealth podcast are not affiliated with CWM LLC. Investment advisory services are offered through CWM LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Please know that converting from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA is a taxable event. A Roth IRA offers tax-free withdrawals on taxable contributions. To qualify for a tax-free and penalty-free withdrawal on earnings, a Roth IRA must be in place for at least 5 tax years. The distribution must take place after age 59 and a half or due to death, disability, or a first-time home purchase of up to $10,000 lifetime maximum. Depending on state law, Roth IRA distributions may be subject to state taxes. Our local address is 1780 Hughes Landing, Suite 570, The Woodlands, Texas, 77380.